Hello, everyone. Paul here. The episode you're about to hear was recorded quite a while ago. It was meant to be our end of the year holiday episode, but I got very ill and was incapacitated for a while, and I didn't have the ability to do things like edit and release podcasts. But I'm back, and I ask you to cast your mind back to the distant past of 2019 and pretend it is the week leading up to the new year. As for 2020, Brian and I will be back with a new episode next week. And we have a lot of great things planned for the year, and I hope you will join us for what we have in store. For now, thank you for your patience and continued support. Please enjoy our take on Camelot 3000.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa.
Ramadan.
Happy all of the happy things that make people happy.
Yes.
Happily.
Yes. Happy festive times in the darkest point of the year.
I forgot Festivus.
Oh, Festivus. Is that still a thing?
Well, for the rest of us.
Kind of set you up for that.
You did. Thank you. You're the straight man in this one.
Which is not my normal role. Today on the program, we'll be discussing the 1982 Maxi series, Camelot 3000, by Mark W. Barr and penciled by Brian Boland. So this is coming out a bit later than we wanted to. So we are going to put our end of the year episode and Camelot 3000 kind of squished together.
Yeah, which is fine.
It's just fine.
Our thousands of listeners will be fine.
I don't think it's quite 1,000 yet, but I think we are in the hundreds.
3,000.
Yes. They came a lot.
Oh.
All right. Yes.
Now, see, there's a setup that I just, let's carry on.
Yes. So this is our last episode of 2019, and we decided to share our top picks and favorite comics of the year. How do you want to do this, Brian? Do you want to go, like,
We could do, like, you know, so I have a couple runners-up that I don't really have any comment on. I just want to mention them.
Okay. Well, do that now.
Let me do that now, and then why don't we just... I'll do five, you do five, I'll do four. We're doing top five, right?
Top five.
Okay. So I just want to throw out, so these are some comics that either started too late to have a true impact on the year or are really good but didn't quite make the cut for whatever reason. So without any serious comment, I just want to say, like, so I've got four titles that I didn't quite squeeze in the top five that I really enjoyed or have started to enjoy. So one is the Martian Manhunter Maxi series by Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo.
Okay.
I really dug, I'm really excited about Pretty Deadly, The Rat by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Emily Rios. That's off to a really good start. Kieran Gillen's and Stephanie Hahn's Die has been very fascinating to me. And also just Greg Rucka returning to DC with a great take along with Mike Perkins on Lois Lane. I've really enjoyed those comics. I just don't feel like they're further along far enough to comment in any serious way. But I think those are worthy comics out there that I've enjoyed throughout the year.
Okay. Well, just so you know, in my top five, I have placed Die from Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Hahn's.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Because that started at the beginning of the year, and I think it's coming. It's one of my favorites. It's one I look forward to on a monthly basis. Yeah. So, I mean, artwork's beautiful, and the story is, you know, just, it's dark Dungeons and Dragons. How can you go wrong with that? Should I just do mine then?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. What is your five, and then I'll do my five.
Okay. So,
your number five.
Yeah. So, this is in no order, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I'm not ranking them because I like them all equally. I like them all equally. I'm an all-inclusive comic book liker.
Good job.
Okay, so Die from Image, just mentioned. This one's kind of a cheat because it's a two-in-one, but Buffy and Angel from Boom.
Huh.
Yeah, I have just been loving this. Full disclosure, I love Buffy. I basically separate my life into pre-Buffy and post-Buffy.
What about the period during Buffy?
Oh, that was just, heavenly. The Buffy the Vampire Slayer series is written by Jordy Belair with art by Dan Mora. And the Angel series is written by Brian Edward Hill, and Gleb Melkinov. Now, but these are, they're a reboot of the Buffy series starting from the beginning, but give it a modern kind of take, with cell phones and social media, but still retaining that essence of the series in it and, that language that Joss Whedon put into it. And yeah, it's really, really good. I've just been enjoying it in all its Buffiness. So that's from Boom. Also from Boom, and this one has just recently started, so I think they're up to issue 5 now. Something is Killing the Children. From Boom. Yeah, by James Tinian IV and Werther Del Edra doing the art. Man, I can't say words.
If folks want pronunciation from us, they're coming to the wrong place.
Yeah. Again, I do the editing. I can fix this in post.
We were English majors. I mean, why should we be able to pronounce names?
So Something is Killing the Children is just a really creepy horror story with this, it's about terrible things in the woods killing children. And you have this mysterious monster hunter coming into town and trying to find out what the mystery is. And it's really, it's creepy and it's interesting and it's building this wider world. I'm really interested to see where it's going to go.
That seems like right up your alley in terms of the horror comics, which is something that you are
a fan of. Yes,
we know you for loving.
Yeah. My next one is Invisible Kingdom from Dark Horse. It's by G. Willow Wilson and art by Christian Ward. But why are you laughing at that?
We may hear that title again later.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
like within a couple minutes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll leave it to you to do it.
I approve of this choice very strongly.
It's if Amazon.com was an intergalactic evil empire.
Yes.
Yeah, this is one that I've just been really enjoying top to
bottom. Christian Ward's art on it is out of this world, and I don't mean that as a pun.
Yeah, literally and figuratively.
It's not really a pun. It's more wordplay than a pun, but. Yes, Christian Ward is turning in some incredible work on this comic.
Yeah, absolutely. And then my final one, I guess, again, is a duel. It's House of X and Power of X from Marvel. Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz.
I heard that was a thing that Marvel was attempting.
Yes. Well, you know what? We've talked about it on the program before, and I was kind of a little skeptical, and I wasn't sure about the story. But once the whole thing came out and I was able to read them in order, both of the series as kind of one big story, it really kind of blew me away. Once you got the whole picture and you could see all the intricacies, I mean, Hickman's use, he just does that sort of thing.
Right. With lots of graphs and.
Yes. Yeah. And the way it weaves in and out of the two series. And when all is said and done, I was incredibly impressed by the whole thing. Interested to see where it's going to go forward, with the ongoings, but...
It doesn't surprise me, I am a big Hickman fan. Now, there are certain things that he's done that I haven't followed because I'm not, and this is one of them, which, again, we've discussed already, that I find X-Men to be too dense to attempt to get into without allowing me for a year of nonstop X-Men reading, back issue reading.
Yep. Well, I do think this is a good jumping on point. Well, again, we've talked about this on another episode. I've come to the conclusion. It is a good jumping on point, and it's actually got me back into the X-Men. So,
Nothing that's else. Good.
Yeah.
Good for Hickman. That says a lot about Hickman in general. And
The unfortunate thing is that now there's a dozen titles coming out.
And I was going to say that's what Marvel does, but then I would have to ignore the fact that DC has at least 50 or 60 Batman-related comics as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So I can't blame Marvel straight up on that one.
Yes. How many Batmans are there? The Batman who laughs, the Batman who sings.
Batman who cries.
Yes, the Batman who eats lunch for breakfast. But that's my list. To give it a rundown again, it's Buffy and Angel from Boom. Invisible Kingdom from Dark Horse, House of X, Power of X from Marvel, Die from Image, and Something is Killing the Children. Again, from Boom. Wow, I have two Booms on my list.
That's a boom.
Huh. It's a very Boom year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, Brian, that's my list. What's yours?
My list is, and I actually ranked them, although, okay. Because that's how, you know, it's...
It is the thing to do.
I am compelled. The spirit of Christ compels me.
The power of lists compels you.
The power of lists compels me. Although, obviously, as with any list, if you ask me tomorrow to make this list, it could be different. But as it stands right now, at five, I'm cheating a little bit. In the last year, I think I listed a bunch of ongoings that had been existing for a while, and it was kind of like, oh, you should just list new comics that just came out. But I'm going to go ahead and go with Daredevil by Chip Zdarsky and Marco Cicchetto
at
number
good.
Five. Yeah. And I'm listing that because it was, you know, it was the yearly reboot that Marvel does. So it's technically new. And I think I have not been enamored with the last several Daredevil writers. And Daredevil is one of my favorite characters. And Daredevil has had some incredible writers throughout his run. And I feel like the last 4 or 5 years of Daredevil have not held to the same standard that I have loved Daredevil in the past. So I really feel like this latest round of Daredevil by Chip Zdarsky in particular has been, it's taken me back to what I have appreciated with Daredevil. And who knew? I know Chip Zdarsky has done some other writing in the past. He's most known before this as an artist, particularly on Sex Criminals, but he's doing incredible stuff with this. So I've been very happy with Daredevil returning to my must-read pile as opposed to the I'll get around to it pile.
Absolutely. I think that's, I've been enjoying that as well. So good choice.
At number four, again, a little bit of a cheat, but Ascender by Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen. As long as Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen are, and Ascender just launched this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's sequel to Descender, which has made my list in the past. But as long as they are writing and drawing, painting in this world, this comic is always going to be towards the top of any list I have in any year. So again, Ascender just launched this year, so I'm not cheating. There it is.
It's not cheating at all. That's perfect.
At number three, The Green Lantern by Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp has been a hoot. Just an absolute hoot. So I have that there. What Grant Morrison is doing, there are so many throwbacks in this comic, and there's so many references, like the team up in, I forget which issue, 6 or 7 or 8, with Green Arrow, was right out of 1977 or 78, and that was a lot of fun. And I feel like Grant Morrison can do wrong, but I don't think I think he rarely does. And I feel like his take on Green Lantern has been a really intriguing way to approach the character. So, been enjoying that.
Okay. Just that has fallen off my radar, and it's one that I've kept wanting to pick back up again, and now I will.
I definitely, you know, it depends on what it's Grant Morrison, you know, there's going to be some really goofy stuff in there, and, you know, but Liam Sharp's art, again, just, he was born to draw this comic.
All right, good to know.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. At number two, I have Invisible Kingdom by G. Willow Wilson and Christian Ward.
That's a really good one.
Yeah. It's just, it's good comics. It's really good comics. That's on Dark Horse, and it's Karen Berger's imprint on Dark Horse,
mm-hmm.
Which I think deserves to be mentioned because I'm not sure that, you know, Karen Berger's imprint is getting as much attention as maybe it should. It's Karen, Stink, and Berger.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's also G. Willow Wilson, who is becoming just anything she writes, I'm just gonna pick it up because
yeah,
I'm just going to enjoy her. Yeah, she's great. We've already mentioned Christian Ward's art.
Yes. So let's just, number one, Number one is Dial H for Hero by Sam Humphries and Joseph Quinn. Yes.
Okay.
I don't think I have enjoyed a comic book more this year than Dial H for Hero. And I don't want to say that it's important. I don't want to say that it's going to set the world on fire, that it's game-changing in any way, shape, or form. But the nature of Dial H for Hero has always demanded that the writer and artist be creating these incredibly surreal, bizarre circumstances that demand demand brand new heroes being molded out of thin air.
Okay.
And what Humphries and Quinones have done with this, it's batshit crazy. I mean that in a good way. It's focused. They know what they're doing. But if people appreciate sort of the old school nature of comics and the creation of absurd superhero characters, and even giving them, so Quinones apes so many different artists throughout this run. It's not over yet. It's nearing the end.
Okay,
but I mean, there's a panel where I think we have a bunch of Image characters. We have Madman is hidden somewhere in the panel. There's a lot going on there, and the story revolves around basically young teenagers who are running around with the dial and all this mythology that goes around the dial. It has been the one comic I have looked most forward to every month, and the one that I think when I put it down, I have been the most satisfied with.
Excellent. That's something that was, again, not on my radar, but I will give it a look.
So there's mine.
So there's our, so run them down again.
So Daredevil, Ascender, The Green Lantern, Invisible Kingdom, and Dial H for Hero.
Fantastic. So we will put all these up on the website as well, just so if anyone wants to write it down. Do you have anything more to add?
Baby Yoda.
Well, Baby Yoda.
That's all I have to say, really.
Has been the joy of the year right now. Baby Yoda is now available as an avatar in Disney Plus, by the way, if you so choose.
Of course.
Yes, both of us have not seen the new Star Wars, but Mandalorian has been pretty darn good.
Yeah, Mandalorian's been great. I think we're both seeing Star Wars this week.
Yes, we are.
Now that I have Disney Plus, I will probably at some point delve into and watch the entirety of the Marvel Universe, cinematic universe.
Yeah, shocking that you have not.
You've
not been following every moment of it.
I know. I have a life.
I see.
He says, whilst he's doing his collected edition podcast. It's been a good year in comics.
I think overall,
we're gonna talk about comics.
Yeah, overall, it's been a great year for comics. Just looking at the list that I chose, I mean, I'm normally picking Marvel DC stuff, but the majority of my list is coming from Image, Boom, Dark Horse.
Yeah.
Even the stuff I left off are mostly things that are coming from not the big two, which I find heartening.
I split it. You know, I have a couple from the big two, or I have two from DC, one from Marvel, one Image, and one Dark Horse.
Yeah. I've also been enjoying Captain America by Ta-Nehisi Coates, but I always mention Captain America, so thought I'd leave that off the list. That technically started last year.
And yet none of us mentioned a Batman comic.
Yeah.
Which I should say, Sean Murphy's The White Knight has actually been quite great.
Okay.
If you're going to pick up a Batman, that's the one I would.
I'm surprised you didn't put Doomsday Clock on there.
The last issue hasn't hit yet.
When's that come out? 2-3 years from now?
Wednesday.
Okay.
So by the time this posts, I believe the issue will be out. I don't know if I would ever put that Watchmen in a top 5 or top 10. I think that it is oddly maligned in a way that it doesn't necessarily deserve. In the same breath, I would say that it is it in equal to its predecessor? or does it deserve, you know, some kind of canonical take? No, neither of those. I think it's better than it should be, but it's not as great as it should have been.
All right. I gave up on
Unlike
it, so
the
I can't.
TV show.
I haven't seen that either, so I have a life, Brian.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that's enough of that. Let's take a break and come back and talk about King Arthur in space.
Indeed.
All right, back in a second.
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too, can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back! Brian, this week is your selection, so tell us all about it.
All right, Paul, I will. Camelot 3000 holds the distinction as being the first maxi series produced by a mainstream comic book publisher. Written by Mike W. Barr and illustrated by collected edition favorite Brian Boland, the 12-issue series was published between 1982 and 1985. This finite series follows the adventures of a resurrected King Arthur and his not-so-merry band of adventurers in, wait for it, the year 3000. To be honest, the title kind of explains the setup from the get-go. The Earth is being invaded by a group of stock aliens and is in dire need of help. Apparently, in the preceding couple of thousands of years, this was the very worst peril the Earth has experienced. So, we cue to the subtly named human person, Tom Prentice, who accidentally revives King Arthur from his slumber, and lo, a mighty quest begins. Bringing in elements of the classic Arthur tales, we see reincarnated versions of Sirs Tristan, Percival, Gawain, Kay, Galahad, and others taking on the pernicious schemes of Modred and Morgan Le Fay. What those schemes are is not exactly clear, but world domination seems to be involved. Merlin shows up and is very grumpy. Lancelot and Guinevere do that thing they are always destined to do. Space age costumes are mysteriously manufactured, and folks are very impressed by modern technology. Excalibur appears, disappears, is found again, gets removed from a stone, gets shoved back into a stone, and is pulled from a stone yet again. Speeches are made, betrayals enacted, and rallying cries exclaimed. All very epic. Perhaps one of the most interesting through lines in the tale is the tale of Sir Tristan, who is reincarnated in the body of a woman. In early 80s parlance, this leads to an intriguing take on gender identification, which, while problematic in contemporary discourse, is a fascinating exploration in the context of an early 80s mainstream comic book. Ultimately, and unsurprisingly, Arthur and his ad hoc roundtable win out over the forces of evil, and Earth is saved once again. Denouements occur for the surviving heroes, and new storylines are hinted at. Also, there are naked people.
Lots and lots of naked people.
So, Paul, my recommendation, what are your thoughts on this?
So very briefly, I guess we'll get into details as we go on. This has not aged well. But that being said, it was doing some really innovative things that I'm impressed with. It was pushing boundaries that just comics weren't doing at that point. It's an amazing thing. It's simultaneously progressive and offensive at the same time. That's quite a feat.
Exactly.
But it is kind of a fun romp. So you can just look at it.
I should clarify, as with my semi snark in the intro, I did enjoy the comic.
Yes, and that's, so I should share that off right off the bat. Yes, I did enjoy the comic. It was a lot of fun to read. There's a lot to dig into, though. I mean, it was really trying to do some interesting things that might not be, that might, yeah, like I said, haven't aged well.
Well, and I think one of the, to me, like one of the, obviously, you know, the, when you, like, particularly when you say it was trying to do some interesting things, I think the Sir Tristan thing is obviously the primary thing.
Yeah.
But there are other aspects in there as well, because I think there's social commentary about nuclear war.
There's a multiracial cast.
You know? Yes.
It's dealing with...
Almost stock, but...
Yeah. Aside from the gender issues, it's just dealing with sexuality in general, which is, you know, in a very mature way that comics just weren't doing at that point.
Numerous sexy time moments.
Yes. And none of these things were handled as deftly as we would see them today. But the fact that they were addressed at all is impressive.
In a mainstream comic.
In a mainstream comic, exactly.
In 1982. It wasn't really a mainstream comic, I think, because it was the Baxter paper, direct sale only.
Well, this kind of led to that.
But it was a mainstream publisher. This is long before Vertigo.
Right. But that's something that's interesting. If we just want to talk about how this thing was created, it's the first comic that was printed on a glossy paper and not, you know, pulp newsprint.
Right.
Which, you know, newsstands at the time, because comics were sold at newsstands primarily and spinner racks in stores. And, right. You know, because of the expensive paper and the expense to buy this, they had, you know, it changed how comics were ordered, and that led to direct sales in the comic book industry, or the, you know, your comic book store that we have today, you know, for better or worse.
Taking the place of your local newsstand.
Exactly. This was a linchpin in changing how comics were acquired. That in and of itself is impressive. Whether you like the way it changed things, you know, that's up to your opinion, but it did change things.
But it's also very interesting that, so I came to this partly because we had just done the Judge Dredd with a few issues by Brian Bolland. Mm-hmm. And it got me thinking about Camelot 3000, because I often read in message boards, and, you know, we all know that going on message boards is not exactly the best path to sanity.
It's always such a rational reason debate on these things.
Right, right. Yes. And, I never comment on, I am a lurker, not a participant. But part of what it that was always very interesting to see when people talk about miniseries and maxi-series and all of the things that go on now, and like how, you know, Marvel basically does 12-issue or 6 to 12-issue arcs and then reboots and what have you. Camelot 3000 is bandied about constantly with nostalgia.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it did pave the way for Watchmen and Dark Knight and Crisis on Infinite Earths and, you know, these maxi series that came later. This was the first.
And it's really interesting, like, reading the sort of love that people have for Camelot 3000. And sometimes I wonder, is this love coming from recent readings, or is it coming from, you know, member berries?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have to admit, rereading this, I was like, oh, I didn't remember it the way it is. That's not to say, I have to keep saying this, it's not bad. It's just there's a few things that come up in it that I kind of go, oh, that could have been stated differently. And for instance, I guess, do you want to get right into the Tristan stuff?
We could do it now, yeah.
I'm happy that it was addressed. I'm not sure it was as sensitive as it should be, because Tristan basically hates herself.
Right. It's so there's you run into, and I have to be very careful here, because I am not speaking for a community.
Oh, no, exactly.
In in this. And so reading this, like the first thing I tried to do was put myself in context of 1982. And so for folks who haven't read it, so Tristan is reincarnated. Tristan was male in Tristan had a male body in
Ithurian legend. Sir Tristan is this very manly man who's very, very good at sword fighting and loving the women
and raping.
Well, yeah, that's always problematic in these stories. So Tristan is reincarnated into the body of a woman and is trying to come to terms with his new gender or her new gender. Pronouns are going to be difficult.
What is interesting is there is a really weird attempt at pronouns in 1982. I don't think it works. I have a feeling that others would also feel that it doesn't work. But what I find interesting is the attempt.
Yes.
In a time in which this is not talked about in a very, you know, outward way.
Exactly. Barr is definitely trying to address things in a way. And I think we talked about this a lot of times in the 70s, where in the 70s and early 80s, people are trying to be more progressive, but we don't have a means to talk about it yet. So we're still using terminology that's coming from the 50s and 60s.
And attitudes and ideas that are coming.
Right. And so it sounds a little tone deaf to our ears today. Yes. But, you know, these people were trying to address really serious situations and really serious.
But there are numerous points where Tristan, you know, the Tom Prentice, who, you know, the man in this, keeps wanting to refer to Tristan as Amber, which was her reincarnated name before she.
Yeah, that's her dead name.
Mind was opened up. Her at the time, mind was opened up and realized that they were Tristan. And so Tom constantly wants to call Tristan Amber, and Tristan is constantly correcting. It's not just Tom. Arthur does it. Arthur keeps wanting to refer to them as Amber, or it's really interesting because there is as I'm doing right now, like a verbal sort of two-step.
Yeah, little verbal gymnastics going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's really fascinating to read this. At one point, Tristan is talking to Guinevere, and I thought this was funny. Guinevere's argument was, being a woman isn't all that bad. A little more forceful argument could have been made there, Gwen, but... But yeah, I mean.
But Tristan replies, is that the point where Tristan replies, imagine if you were born in the body of Lancelot?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the writer's heart is in the right place. He's really trying to, you know, push these issues into the forefront and make a positive statement. It just comes
across. And there are very strong moments where Tristan says, I am not the person inside that my body represents.
Exactly. It's just, you know what? It might be. Because I think just in general, this story feels a bit rushed. Even though it is 12 issues, right. There's a lot of plot points brought up, rushed through, and then moved on.
And kind of, or just completely abandoned.
Oh, yes, exactly. And it's possible that if this storyline had been given enough time to sort of gestate a little bit, I don't normally argue for decompression, but I kind of wish this was stretched out a little bit longer.
Where some of the problematic things occur is like others' inability to ever recognize Tristan's conflict.
Exactly.
Some folks come to it, and in the end, and there's also a little bit of you're just confused.
Exactly.
In some of the dialogue, yeah.
Can't you just try not being
right?
The best character though is Isolde, who finally says, "You know, I don't care. I love you for who you are and the person you are." And I think that's a wonderful conclusion to that story.
Yeah. And the ultimate conclusion is love is love.
Yeah, exactly. And that's brilliant.
And it's, clunky getting there. And
yeah, getting there was a little bit of a tough ride.
Even at the end when Tristan is, the last we see of Tristan, they are wearing a wedding dress,
yeah,
which is kind of an odd option to take.
it's a standard early 80s symbology. So it's you know, they're getting wedding. They're getting married. Regardless of gender, you have to wear a wedding dress.
Yeah. So and white.
And white.
I think this is one of the things that's very indicative is where I see this also in the plot as a whole, but this is kind of the microcosm, the craw, where you see, like what you mentioned, it's the big idea, the attempt to say a thing and not being able to really say it without a bunch of preconceived notions mucking things up a little bit.
Yeah. And you gotta know that editorial was in here going, wait a second, we can't say this and we can't say that. So I wonder, you know, I'm guessing here, but there had to have been a few things changed.
Right. But I think editorial, I mean, you can see where editorial left some things alone.
Yes. Yes, it's true.
Which is fascinating. And I was reading this, the individual issues. So I was reading some of the letters.
Oh, I didn't read any of that.
Letters to the editor, which were also very interesting and oddly supportive.
Oh, really?
That's
fantastic.
Again, some of the language we would not use today, and some of the preconceived notions we would not use, we would try to not use today. But at the same time, it seemed like readers were attempting to go along with the journey.
Well, that's good.
With as open a mind as possible. So, again, I'm not excusing Paul and I are not excusing aspects of this that are troubling, particularly the more we know now and the more we try to know now. Still,
yeah. I'm going to say this probably a dozen times before we finish this recording, but it is attempting really impressive things. Doesn't always hit the mark. But, you know, but I'm going to give it props for trying.
Yeah. Anyway,
another really fascinating idea that I wish had been developed more is Percival becoming, because Percival is in Arthurian myth is the pure, innocent, unblemished soul.
Right.
And then in this one, he's the Neo Man. He is actually a monster.
He's transformed along with a lot of other prisoners and other individuals into these creatures called the Neo Men.
So, but I really like the idea that he was, you know, the pure soul is given this corrupt body. That is kind of played with a little bit. Overall, it doesn't go anywhere and it kind of gets dropped.
Well, and again, it's not to go back to Tristan once again, but I am. is Percival and Tristan both. There are moments that they are the most spiritually akin or to each other, like throughout the comic, it's shown because they are both the other for whom what is inside them is not reflected in the body.
Exactly.
And exactly. And so there are numerous moments throughout this comic where Tristan and Percival have there's a level of camaraderie there and a level of concern for each other that is different than the other characters show for each other.
Yes, absolutely. But even in the rather convoluted Guinevere and Lancelot subplot, I mean, they're trying to talk about, okay, so this is an endless recurring cycle that's going to happen over and over again, but they're also trying to go against their nature and become something different. That plot line, again, is too rushed. They have an affair, they're banished, they're forgiven, they're back to being, it's just kind of, it's all over the
place. Yeah, and it's like, to me, it's like Lancelot and Guinevere are the least interesting characters.
Yeah.
Because it is Lancelot and Guinevere doing what they always do.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether they're fated to do that, that's another.
And they're the only supporting, you know, round table knights who get reincarnated exactly as they were.
Right.
So Lancelot's still a white Frenchman and Guinevere's still a white English woman.
Although it's also really weird. The other part of the issue I have is like, as soon as, what is it, Acton, I think her commander Acton is Guinevere's character before she is magically her mind is magically open to who she really is. So she's like the commander of the military forces. And then when she becomes Guinevere, she gets sidelined, completely sidelined, and she spends all her time lounging around in bed.
Well, you know, I bet if I was a queen, I'd lounge around in bed all the time, too.
okay.
Yeah, that statement could be taken in many different ways.
But she goes from this, like, this really powerful, strong character to, you know, the realization that she's a queen suddenly, because these people still retain, like, all of these characters who are reincarnated, Galahad, Kay, Gawain, all of them, they retake their memories of who they were back in the Arthurian legend days, but yet they have a full memory of who they were before their enlightenment.
Exactly, which is really fascinating too, because, which one is it that has the family?
It's Gawain.
Gawain. Yeah, so Gawain has a family, and he still keeps, you know, wanting to be back with them. Which is, again, another subplot that's sort of thrown in there, supposed to add some tension, but it's not, doesn't really go anywhere. There's a lot of ideas in this comic. Obviously, Barr and Boland were just, you know, brimming over. They read a lot of Lamort de Arthur.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And they cite a lot of other sources in the letters pages.
Yeah. I mean, they do.
There's whole essays written by Barr in the comic, like at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, they are following the basic storylines of all these characters, you know, at least in the Cliff Notes version. They're hitting all the greatest hits, which is fine. That's all you really need. This is, you know, just the premise of King Arthur in the year 3000, King Arthur in space. that's wonderful.
Which is his.
I really like it just in general. And, you know, so obviously they're just brimming over with all these ideas, and they're just throwing them all on every page. Boland, for sure, he's just, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so Boland is just, I mean, he's going crazy with all his depictions of things. He's having a lot of fun.
Yeah, apparently, though, the comic was delayed greatly, particularly towards the end.
Was it true that he had an anchor? He was working in England, and his anchor was in the U.S., so the pages were going back and forth. That's got to be a delay in 1983.
Well, and I think Boland didn't really like having an anchor. And so, like, one of the things I was reading, like, doing a little bit of research for this, was Boland would change the style so much that the anchor had very little to do. Right. You know, so I think it was Terry Austin, who is an anchor of some note. Yeah. But I guess Boland, the slowdown, like, because I think the last couple issues were severely delayed.
Well, like a year. Yeah, the last issue was delayed almost a year, if not more.
Which was kind of prescient to...
they were ahead of their game. In so many ways, yeah.
But at the same time, it's, again, I generally don't have a problem with... I get enough comics that if I don't get my issue of whatever every month, that I'm going to lose my mind and start ranting on, you know, forums. Mm-hmm. Because I am of the, I would prefer the same artist work on something. If it takes a little extra time, it takes a little extra time. So that to me is fine. And again, like you said, Boland's art is, it's worth the wait.
Yeah.
It's just so good. It's so detailed and intricate realistic feeling with it's cartoony, but you know, it's not photorealism, but
it's fantastic.
So good.
Yeah, it's perfect for this story, you know, which is kind of cartoony and off the wall, but still has a little, it's still grounded in reality as far as the subject matters that they're dealing with.
So one of the things, so we could get into the plot a little bit more, although I think that the plot is kind of basic. So, Paul, I already told you this, but just for the sake of, it's been a long time since I have read any Arthurian legend stuff from, whether it be T.H. White or Mallory or whoever else. And so when I was reading this, I intentionally did not go back and research the Arthurian legends, because I kind of wanted to say, I wanted to see if the story would stand on its own, and did I need to know the essential plot, did I need to remember the essential plot lines or themes of the original Arthurian realm, world. And so that's how I kind of approach this.
Which I think is perfectly valid. And in my mind, you don't really need to, it's nice to have that little background, but you don't need to know it. Because what's in the popular culture about Arthur pulls the sword from the stone and Merlin is his advisor and Lancelot and Guinevere have an affair. I mean, that's all, these are all the plot points you need to know.
Right. And Merlin's a dick.
Merlin is a dick. He's more dickish than he is normally portrayed, I think. I always have a soft spot for Morgan Le Fay.
Well, particularly as drawn by Brian Boland.
Well, yeah. That is, she's comfortable.
Apparently is not affected by changes in temperature.
No, not that I could tell.
But you mean more thematically.
Yes, I mean more thematically. She always just seems to be a little bit screwed over.
As does Mordred, really, if memory serves me.
Yeah.
Now, we get in this, we get their backstories, or the comic book version of their backstories.
And at least the story we get from their perspective of how Mordred was conceived. Is Arthur the hero?
Well, isn't that interesting?
I think we might be rooting for the wrong guy.
I think at one point in my notes here, I wrote, Arthur's kind of an a-hole.
Yeah.
I mean, he's killing babies.
Yeah, he's doing the raping.
Yeah, he's trying to control Guinevere. It doesn't seem like he really loves her. He just wants to own her.
I mean, he does have that moment at the end where he sort of allows them to be together, and then he mopes away in sad sack, you know?
Right.
Incel way. They don't love me, boy.
Arthur's an incel.
He just keeps pulling his sword from a stone.
Which is, of course, completely subtle.
Yep. His hard sword can slice through anything. Anyway, I may have to remove this part. But yeah, the other aspect of Arthur is that he immediately takes control and authoritarian.
Nice.
So it's kind of, I like the fact that it's a little gray. I mean, obviously we're supposed to root for King Arthur and his merry band of round tablers. Supposed to root for them, and they are the heroes. But at the same time, they're not depicted as flawless, which is good.
Right. Well, we have Sir Kay, who pretty corrupt too, and gets several, semi-betrays the round table several times in this comic. And keeps getting forgiven, and even then, he gets to be redeemed.
I actually thought that Kay gives that explanation where he's a jerk all the time because he brings people together by their hatred of him.
Right.
That was interesting because again, to get to the original source material, Kay's an idiot. Kay's a complete moron in the right. original Arthurian tales. So this actually gave him a little bit of authority.
Did he introduce nuance?
Yeah, exactly. Which I appreciated. He's still a jerk.
Yeah. I think Gawain and Galahad also suffer a bit on characterization. We get a little bit of characterization.
Well, they're given, this is who I am, this is my motivation, and nothing is done with it.
And then they just kind of, prance about, like, as knights are prone to do, and, waving their swords or their laser swords or what have you.
But I do like that they were given different races. Again, they're trying to do really cool things. Other than, wearing a samurai outfit, nothing's really done with it.
Right. We had that bit at the beginning where, Galahad is attempting to kill himself because he's dishonored his family or dishonored himself or whatnot. So that's a through line, too, where in the end, Galahad still gets to kill himself.
Yeah. Hooray. I do, there's a couple of things in here. First of all, the way the world leaders are presented. Holy cow. Yeah. There's a lot of stereotypes going on there.
It's the American president is a cowboy.
But flash forward to 2000. Is it that far off?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, but no, but it's very prescient in the fact that they list China as a world power. That wasn't a right. thing. That wasn't a thing in 1982. Again, they have so many good ideas. I wish were executed just a little bit better.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like, I guess here we could finally get around to the plot.
Well, great. Sure. What are we, 30 minutes in? Sure, let's get to the plot.
but this alien race is attacking the Earth.
From the 10th planet.
From the 10th planet.
Sorry, guys. It would only be the 9th. Anywho.
No. The world is in chaos, and so this guy, Tom Prentice, accidentally revives King Arthur. And of course, as you said, King Arthur just kind of takes over and, you know, here we go, you know. Yeah. So there's a lot of running around and pulling swords out of things. There's the getting the gang together portion of the comic.
Yeah, it's kind of like a heist movie where you got to get everyone.
Right. Then there's like a bunch of battle sequences, and then Morgan Le Fay and Modred are revealed, and Arthur and Guinevere get married, and then she's killed, but then Lancelot brings her back to life by praying. Another attack happens. Tom Prentice is mortally injured, which sends them off on a quest for the Grail. The Grail is found. Tom Prentice is healed. The Grail is stolen.
Percival gets to ascend to heaven, which is nice.
Percival gets to go to heaven. And then everybody ends up on the 10th planet and fights. And then Excalibur is used as a nuclear weapon.
Which is interesting.
And then everybody lives happily ever after.
Sort of. Because everything's kind of screwed. And they ask Merlin, hey, could you help us out with this? And he says, no, I gotta screw off here. This is all going to happen again pretty soon. So I'm just going to get ready for that. It's like, well, why don't you just help fix it now? And then it doesn't have to happen. Okay, bye. All right, see ya. I'll see you later then. Okay.
I'm leaving out. I mean, a lot of stuff happens. I'm, you know, it's, but that's the basic plot.
Well, there's a lot of machinations between with Morgan Le Fay, who she's trying to get everyone to turn on each other so that she can get the Grail.
Tristan, right. She tempts Tristan with magically reverting Tristan back to male presenting and what have you. So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of intricacies and twists and turns, but essentially it's just two armies are brought together and they fight a bit. But this is really just a vehicle for those ideas just to be thrown at you as quickly as possible. And it makes you think.
And, you know, I mean, and again, it's it's also a vehicle for Brian Boland's art, which we've talked about. You know, it is a grand space epic, and it's presented with all of the great tropes that we like about big space epics.
And it's got the fantasy elements too, with all the fantasy stuff that we like, you know, all the fantasy tropes that we like. It is a fun romp. You know?
And I do really like that last page.
With the squiggly biggly Arthur pulling the sword out of the stone.
Guy pulling the sword out. I mean, sure. I mean, it's exactly what you want to see in the Arthurian legend, right? I mean, you want to see some other group. And I like the fact that it's not humans, you know, and it's so that it's the idea that Arthur and the legend of Arthur can live on, not just on Earth or with humanoids.
I do like the fact that these squid-like creatures did evolve to have swords and anvils. That's neat.
Well, of course.
That's universal, I think. yeah, okay. There's one cover of this where Brian Boland has drawn Arthur holding Guinevere's dead body. It looks almost exactly like Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, was that directly lifted?
I feel as if it has to have been a reference, although I've never read where. But yeah, you're talking about Superman carrying Supergirl.
Exactly. And that, of course, has been mimicked and parodied and homaged over the years, over and over and over again. And then when you look at this cover for, what is it, issue 3, you say, holy cow, I've seen this image before. I was kind of taken aback by how much has been taken from this. This was a pretty influential storyline.
Yes. And I think that's part of the reason why I think it still exists so strongly in comic book fans, you know, sort of mindset or in our mythology, no pun intended.
No, I agree with you that it was the inspiration to so many things going forward that when you look back on it, you look back on it fondly because you know what's going to happen or what's going to come of it.
And I think even despite all that we've said preceding this, having reread it, I still think of it fondly.
Oh, yeah.
You have to, I would recommend if people go back to reread it, approach it appropriately.
Right. Yeah. I mean, let me say, overall, I think this series is important. Like I said, it addressed issues directly that previously were only hinted at, if at all.
Right.
At least
in mainstream comics.
Exactly. It innovated things in the production and sale of comics that had long-lasting impacts, for better or worse. And like I said, didn't age well, but it should be read and appreciated for what it's trying to do in the context of its time.
Absolutely.
And if nothing else, it's a fun romp.
It is. And at the end of the day, it is exactly what it should. Right. It's fun.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's King Arthur in space.
King Arthur space. Don't take it too seriously, but...
appreciate it for what it was trying to do in its time.
Right.
All right. Has this run its
course? I don't think I have a lot to add.
No. Read it. It's good.
Yeah.
You might cringe a little bit from time to time. Take it in stride.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Approach it with the expectation of cringe.
Exactly.
Well, so I think we both recommend this, but
with the caveats in place.
Yes. Silliness does run rampant.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, that's Camelot 3000, or at least our oh-so-brilliant take on it. I believe, Paul, that you are responsible for our next bit of comic book entertainment.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us?
I will. We won't be back to the new year, but, it will still be Star Wars mania at that point. So my choice for next time is Dr. Aphra Volume 1, or Aphra. Brian says Aphra, I say Aphra. Someone's going to have to correct us. Say who's right. I'm asking the listeners, not you.
No, okay.
So that is, of course, by Kieran Gillen and with art by Kev Walker. Of all the Star Wars comics that have come out in the new Marvel era, this is my favorite.
It's mine as well.
And this is the first story arc that covers issues 1 through 8. And we get Chewbacca as a bounty hunter and evil R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Yeah, some of my favorite characters are introduced in this. I love these characters.
And I realize that they have different names. Yeah. Yes. And plus we get to see Darth Vader, which is neat, being menacing.
As he does.
As he does. So that's it. Dr. Aphra, Volume 1. That's issues 1 through 8.
Excellent. This should be fun.
Okay, so thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Now let us know your comments. What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? How do you feel about Camelot in space? So you can contact us at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. Send us an email. Or go to Twitter at @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected ED Pod. And just let us know how we're doing. Or just say hi. That's cool, too.
Howdy.
Howdy. So until next time, again, thank you, everybody. And keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
And the Angel series is written by Brian Edward Hill, and Gleb Melkinikov. How's that?
Sure, that works for me.
Boy, I'm going to have to edit that.